Welcome to the Grace Story Podcast, where we introduce you to interesting people and their inspiring stories. From Grace professors, current students, and distinguished alumni, to special guests and speakers on our campus, you can meet new people and hear how they are impacting the world around them. This podcast is recorded and produced at Grace College and Seminary, located on the shores of Winona Lake in the great state of Indiana. This is the Grace Story Podcast. Today, our guest on the podcast is Michael Graham. Michael is currently working with the Gospel Coalition as the director of the Keller Center. You'll recognize that name, Tim Keller. The Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics. He obtained his Master of Divinity from Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando and has utilized his training in theology to evangelize and educate other Christians, both through his time as a pastor and in his work at the Keller Center. You may recognize his name from the book he recently co-authored called The Great Dechurching. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Drew.
And welcome to Northern Indiana.
Yes.
You're in Southern Indiana a lot for the TGC conference, yes. But you made it up to the good part.
Yeah, you know, I was actually born less than 2 hours from here.
Really?
In East Lansing, Michigan.
Okay, yeah.
So I have Midwestern roots.
Did you grow up there or just born there?
You know, we moved when I was two. But when you still have culture, you know, that comes in your suitcase in terms of, you know, the language that you use, uh-huh. You know, the food that you make and kind of your, you know, your principles. And, you know, both my parents grew up on farms and these kinds of things. So the Midwest is still with me in some ways.
But football team wise, I mean, that's the important part. Have you stuck with Michigan State or have you gone SEC on us down there in Florida?
So I'm alumni from University of Florida, so I am a Gator. I did marry a Buckeye, and so we all hate Michigan.
There you go. You have that in common.
We got that in common. So
that's good.
My first year of marriage, the Gators beat the Buckeyes, though, in the college football national championship game and in the basketball NCAA tournament. So year one of marriage
she checked off two.
Yeah, she took two L's on those. So
that's awesome. So you live in Orlando now. Talk to us just a little bit about your journey first into ministry, how the Lord called you into ministry and what ministry looked like for you in your first years.
Yeah, so originally I was, in terms of, you know, Michael's plan for his life.
Sure.
I had done research in building mathematical models for stock short-term time series stock market prediction.
Oh, boy.
And this was in the late 90s when I was in high school. And that research went pretty well. You know, I was doing stuff like the science fairs and those kinds of things. And the research was actually pretty effective, and I gave lectures at Johns Hopkins University before I could drive on my research. Well, long story short, I grew up lower middle class, and I wanted to go to and study this at MIT because they were the only program in the country that had an undergraduate, what they call quantitative finance mm-hmm. program. And so that was my big plan. But when my financial aid packet came back, you know, despite, you know, growing up with very modest means, they said I could afford a sum of money that was basically my father's entire salary, you know, for the year. And so I ended up at University of Florida. And I read two books my freshman year that radically changed my life. The first was A.W. Tozer's The Pursuit of God. And the second was John Piper's Desiring God. Mm. And it was somewhere in the middle of reading those books that I felt a call towards pastoral ministry. And so that was a, you know, that kind of internal sense of call was something that was just kind of worked itself out, both in terms of my volunteering efforts as a student with Campus Crusade for Christ, now CRU, and then a local church there, an evangelical free church that I was a member at, mm. In terms of the external call. So, and then after my time at Florida, I went overseas with CRU to Italy, was a missionary there from 2004 to 2005, and then returned to Orlando, where I grew up, to attend Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando. So after that, did church planting, helped plant two churches in downtown Raleigh. One was a good experience, one was not a great experience.
One for two in church planning is actually pretty good batting average.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then, returned to Orlando after our time in Raleigh and became the executive pastor at Orlando Grace Church for a decade. And Jim and I had, Jim Davis, the co-author of The Great Dechurching, we had been overseas with crew in Italy together.
Oh, wow.
Not on the same team in the same city at the same time, but we knew each other from 20 years before. And so when our teaching pastor was going to retire, we hired Jim to be our next teaching pastor. So, and then 2 years ago, I moved from being on staff with, on the pastoral staff of Orlando Grace Church to the Gospel Coalition. When a good friend of mine, Colin Hansen, who's the vice president and editor-in-chief for TGC, contacted me with this idea about the Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics. So been full-time with that role for the last 2 years, but still a member at Orlando Grace.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So
let's talk a little bit about the Keller Center, just so people get a sense. And maybe just for those who wouldn't know, give us like what is TGC? And then more specifically, what is the aim of the Keller Center specifically?
Yeah, so TGC stands for the Gospel Coalition. And it was co-founded by D.A. Carson and the late Tim Keller. And both of them had spent, Carson and Keller met each other actually in England, not in the United States. And in England, the U.K. is further down the path in terms of post-Christendom, secularization, these different kinds of things. But they had more infrastructure in the British evangelicals had more infrastructure in terms of having places where broadly gospel-centered people were able to fellowship together and form sinew, ligaments, connective tissue between denominations, silos, ministries, these different kinds of things. And so a little over 20 years ago now, that began conversations between Carson and Keller of, well, we actually kind of need something like this here in the United States, and we don't have it. And so, that birthed kind of the initial meetings that became the Gospel Coalition, where Carson and Keller invited 40 or 50 other pastors throughout the country, Baptists, Presbyterians, other gospel-centered people to convene, in Chicago at Trinity for their kind of initial meeting and kind of work on their foundation documents. So the whole point of the Gospel Coalition is, largely has evolved into a website that will create written content, audio content, video content, live interactive cohorts, and then conferences. So those being kind of the five main ways that people interact with the Gospel Coalition. And all of those things serve the same purpose, and that is to help people be able to know the gospel and to be able to communicate the gospel in ways that are compelling and comprehensible in the communities where we live, work, and play. And so underneath the Gospel Coalition, our department, the Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics, one of the things, if you think about it, okay, first is, what is cultural apologetics, okay? So if you think about the 20th century, the main questions that people had about Christianity were questions about truth. Is the Bible reliable? Did Jesus raise from the dead? Questions about the Trinity, these kinds of things. In the 21st century, the questions have shifted a little bit. And when you think about those classic Greek, categories of truth, goodness, and beauty, well, a lot of the questions have shifted from, is Jesus true, to is he good and is he beautiful? And so those are the kinds of questions that cultural apologetics basically address. And so our role is to, not at the expense of, still answering the questions like, sure. Is the gospel true? Is the Bible true? All of these things, demonstrating the truth of our creeds and confessions. But we're also answering these questions of, is Jesus good? And is he good for the world? Is he for human flourishing? Is he for our shalom? Yes. Yes, and amen to all of these things. And so those things just kind of require new tools, new framing, new language, and how we take the gospel in ways. And again, you know, it all goes back to helping people see these things in a comprehensible and compelling way, especially to highly secular people.
Hmm. I actually had a student helping me prepare for the interview, and he's like slipped in a, like, this is my particular question. And it's centered a little bit around this, which was, he wanted to know, like, yes, okay, kind of like you said, 20th century, like big questions of, you know, the basics of the gospel, you could say, the Romans Road sort of gospel thing. But his question was more like, how does the gospel like impact me as a 21-year-old who, you know, is assessing culture and is trying to understand my way in this confusing world? And so give us an example, or talk to us a little bit about then how you applied the gospel to a cultural assessment, apologetic issue that resonates with, say, a college student.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I want to start high altitude, and then I want to zoom in. So the first thing I want to say is the difference between a 2-chapter gospel and a 4-chapter gospel. Mm. So we have a 4-chapter gospel, and that's creation, fall, redemption, consummation, or recreation. Okay, in the 20th century, the kinds of churches that I grew up in, which trended, you know, kind of more towards fundamentalism, we had a 2-chapter gospel, and that was just fall and redemption. You know, we have a problem, we have a solution. You know, there's 4 different relationships that humans have. Every human has these 4 relationships. There's the vertical relationship that we have with God. There's the horizontal relationship that we have with other people. There's the internal relationship that we have with ourselves. And then there's the relationship that we have with creation itself. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so the challenge with the 2-chapter gospel is it really only addresses redemption in the primarily in the vertical relationship. And is that the core of the gospel, and is that central to the gospel? 100% absolutely yes. You cannot have the gospel without like having that vertical relationship made right, okay? However, when you forget that first chapter of creation and that 4th chapter of recreation or the consummation of the kingdom, you forget about how the gospel brings redemption in our horizontal relationships, in the relationship that we have with ourselves, with our own story, in the relationship that we have with creation itself. And so I think that, you know, so that's in the abstract. Let's get concrete. Mm-hmm. You know, so cultural apologetics. So let's talk about, you know, a very easy subject, like, say, gender and sexuality, okay?
Yeah.
Nothing controversial,
right? Yeah,
here.
Nothing.
So when we, you know, let's talk about transgenderism for a minute, okay? When we talk about idols, we want to be able to do 3 things with every idol that we look at. We want to be able to comprehend it. We want to say what's commendable, you know, where's their truth? You know, there's always enough truth to float the lie. Where's the truth? And then we can move on to critique. And after critique, then we can talk about how the gospel subversively fulfills the things that led us to that idol to begin with.
Sure.
So, and Keller was really strong at this. So let's talk about transgenderism for a second as an idol. Okay, this is a challenging thing, okay? And it's a hard thing, and it's a very controversial one. So let's take a look at it, and let's take a really difficult example, because you're talking about, you know, if you have a church of 100 people, you know, you're going to have at least one household in your church where this conversation is touching that.
Right.
Okay. So every idol does one very important thing. It overpromises and it underdelivers. But idols are usually connecting to something that relate to either our wants or our fears. And the things that are underneath those idols, the wants and fears, we ought to take those wants and fears seriously. So let's say part of your story was some kind of, there was a relationship that was there that was broken, or it was entirely missing, or it was just marred by sin in mm-hmm. some very challenging way, such that that third relationship, the relationship that you have with yourself, becomes very broken. Well, we can understand that some people who have a very broken relationship with themselves, you know, we can understand why they might, you know, that the brokenness of that relationship, particularly with the advent of technology and people's media diets, you know, you can go down a rabbit hole very quickly on things. And so, you know, when we think about, you know, comprehending, we can understand, you know, why if somebody has, you know, this challenging relationship with their self and their story, we can understand from their wants and their fears, well, that's a really scary thing. You know, and if you feel like, you know, your relationship with yourself is really broken, and you're, what is that going to lead you to? It's going to lead you to try to look for answers, you know, on those things. And so, and it's not a bad thing for people to want to have a healthy relationship, you know, with themselves. But the, you know, so that's where we kind of get into the, you know,
there's a bit of truth there.
Yeah, there's a little bit of truth there. Now, the challenge with idols is certain idols are far more deceptive than others. And sometimes certain idols will, the worship that it demands of you, the cost-benefit analysis is often quite bad. So certain idols have really positive cost-benefit analysis. You know, when you think about greed and people who worship, you know, who are workaholics and these kinds of things, well, if you worship that idol, well, it's going to flow well with culture and society. And then you have other idols, like this one, where if you go down that path, you're going to have a lot of friction in a lot of different ways. And so when you look at the, when the with the transgenderism idol, you're talking about something that is that's asking a lot more and more and more of you the more, you know, each kind of step that you take down it. First, it's you have to have a different conception of yourself. And that might begin to manifest itself in terms of a new name for yourself. It might result in, you know, different pronouns. And then, it, you know, that's not going to be enough. They're going to ask for maybe you start dressing differently. And then maybe there's adjustments to your chemical, you know, makeup of, you know, inside of your body. And then maybe you're asking more and more of the people around you in terms of the ways in which they relate to you. And so, you know, certain idols, you know, every idol has its cost-benefit analysis. And so, but on either polarities, when we're looking at idols, the ones that have a very bad cost-benefit analysis to them, in other words, what it's asking of you and its payoff, so I would put, you know, the transgenderism idol here on this end of that spectrum, versus on the other end of the spectrum, where the cost-benefit analysis seems to move very smoothly with culture and society. When you're looking at either of those two polarities, those idols are the most deceptive. Because in this community here, because of what's being asked of you, you're going to form very tight and very narrow communities. And you're going to find a lot of meaning, identity, and purpose in that common community. Over here, this is more individualistic. But it still flows with, you know, it flows with the rhythms of culture.
With the rest of society.
And so therein lies the challenges and the deceptions involved. But we want to take people's wants, because I think all of discipleship and evangelism just comes down to those two questions. What do you want, and what are you afraid of? Whether somebody doesn't know Jesus yet, those are the two most important questions. And whether they already know Jesus, those are the two most important questions. What do you want, and what are you afraid of? Because the gospel speaks to both of those things. And so kind of in terms of the subversive fulfillment piece, it's like, well, you know, in either of these two, you know, kind of polar, kind of opposite idols in terms of cost-benefit analysis, you have, well, we take the wants and the fears seriously. This person over here, they're looking for redemption and shalom in the relationship that they have with themselves. Well, we can look upon that person with tremendous empathy and compassion and understanding and know that they're not going to be able to find that in that idol because the idol's deceiving them. But we do know that redemption and shalom with our relationship with ourselves and our own stories, it can be found and is found in mm-hmm. Jesus and the gospel. And so, you know, that would just be an example mm-hmm. of kind of cultural apologetics to be able to just think of, okay, let's think about what's the idol that's going on here? How can we comprehend, commend, critique it? And then how does the gospel come in and subversively fulfill what it is that that person is looking for? So those things are going to be wants and fears, and those wants or fears are probably going to relate to some kind of brokenness in one of those four relationships, you know, the vertical, horizontal, self, or creation itself.
You talked about transgender, which is a great example, probably not one much of our audience struggles with, but they can understand, at least become more empathetic and understanding of how the gospel applies. The greed example, we all are kind of like, ooh, ouch. That one kind of hits me. So what, I mean, as you sort of assess, and I'm asking you to do this on the fly, like
yeah.
what relationship would you say that idol relates to of the four you spoke about? And maybe what wants and fears questions are we trying to answer in our sort of ease towards greed?
Yeah, so greed, I think, is more about self-reliance from the vertical relationship. You know, we no longer need the vertical relationship because the kinds of things that we want from God, namely security, identity, meaning, purpose, we can purchase these things through, you know, through financial means. Mm-hmm. And so, or greed becomes a way of controlling our horizontal relationships. In other words, well, you know, if I'm a, let's say there's something in my story that I had a chaotic upbringing, okay? And, or I was in want for certain things throughout my life, for legitimately or illegitimately,
sure.
Okay? And what greed tells you is that your insecurity around the ways in which either provision or your ability to control other relationships, you can deal with that insecurity by basically having financial means. And you can control your circumstances or you can control your relationships basically through financial means. Mm. And so I think the greed idol is primarily speaking to that first relationship and that second relationship. It could also relate to your relationship with creation as well, of just like, well, you know, the kind of keeping up with the Joneses mm-hmm. kind of thing of like, oh, you know, always wanting the bigger and better whatever it is,
yeah.
you know, vehicle, home, bank account, those kinds of things.
That's good.
So.
Oof. Okay. Well, I want to get to the book a little bit, but in doing so, I'd love for you just to express a little bit about who you are or your makeup, and then that'll get us to the book, because in this conversation, I've just sort of identified that, you know, you're a deep thinker theologically, and also you're very analytical. You know, I mean, you're writing statistical models before you can drive a car, which I was not doing at 15, 16 years old. So how do those like play together in sort of what you're doing now and even in the book itself?
Yeah, so I've always been a big nerd. And so I've always been interested also just in interdisciplinary, you know, ways that, you know, different disciplines kind of can relate or influence each other. And so having a mathematical wiring, you know, combined with, you know, interest both in theology, but especially evangelism,
mm-hmm.
all of those things kind of intersect, you know, in this kind of idea of cultural apologetics. So as it pertains to, so when you think about, so Jim Davis and I, Jim's the teaching pastor at Orlando Grace, you know, church where I'm currently a member. We had run across some data that had said that 42% of our city had dechurched. And de-churching is a phenomenon where basically somebody has had a long-term habit of church going on a monthly or greater basis, and now they don't go at all. And so when we ran across that data from Barna, and this was about 7 years ago, well, we're like, if 42% of our city, I mean, that's the third largest demographic behind gender and then ethnicity in our city. So if that's the third biggest demographic, we better know something about, well, who are these de-churched people? And we were 6% evangelical as a city at the same time. And that was the same as Seattle or New York City, 6%. Hmm. So we're like, well, why does Orlando feel so much different than Seattle or New York City? And we realized, well, those are unchurched cities, and we're a de-churched city. And this is what you would refer to as religious residue. Orlando has a lot more religious residue than those other cities. We have cultural memory of these things, whereas those cities do not. And so that has a difference. That makes a difference in terms of, you know, how a city feels. And so we realized, okay, well, we better know, you know, we were going to do a whole podcast season on de-churching in America, and we were just going to digest all the research that was out there. And the most recent research we could find at the time was 2014. It was only about 1,000 people and a handful of questions. So we're like, well, we can't do this season on de-churching for our podcast called As in Heaven on the TGC Podcast Network, you know, because we don't have any research to, like, we're not just like lick our finger, throw it up in the air and say, de-churching is about this, you know. That's not how I'm wired. I'm a researcher, I need I need hard data. I'm not going to say anything until we have hard information on these things. And so, especially in the internet age where, you know, everyone just says, it's this, you know, it's like, oh, I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. You know, let's test it. Yeah. So anyways, super long story short, we raised a bunch of money and conducted a three-phase study, about 7,000 people with about 600 data points per person. And to just kind of see, okay, how many people are we talking about? When did they leave? Why did they leave? Are they willing to return? All of these different kinds of things. And so what we learned at the highest altitude is that 1 in 6 American adults had de-churched. That's 40 million people. So that's more than the first Great Awakening, second Great Awakening, and all the Billy Graham Crusades combined. All those people left church. Okay. Now, about 20 million of that is out of Roman Catholic and mainline Protestant contexts, and about 15 million of that is out of evangelical contexts. And so we know the most about the people who left evangelical churches. And if you read our book, The Great De-Churching, you can read about the four different types of people who left evangelical churches. They're very different groups of people with very different beliefs, with varying degrees of, you know, being willing to return, all of these different kinds of things. But the good news, in the middle of all the bad news of all these people, you know, stopping going to church, over half the people who left evangelical churches are willing to return to those same churches today. And the a lot of the reasons why they stated, you know, to do that were very reasonable things. So going into before we did this research, there were basically two older stories that were being told. The two older stories that were being told, if your media diet leaned a little bit to the left, the story that was being told there, well, it's the church's fault. All these people stopped going to church because it's the church's fault. So it's racism, misogyny, clergy scandal, clergy abuse, political syncretism, Christian nationalism, those kinds of things. If your media diet leaned a little bit to the right, then the story that was being told there is it's the culture's fault. So secular progressivism, the sexual revolution, those kinds of things. Now, can you find a few million people that fit either of those two stories? Yes, you can. So it's not that either of those two stories were totally wrong. They were just incomplete. So about 30 of the 40 million people who left houses of worship in America don't fit those two older stories. Okay, you know, and the story that fits the majority of the people who stop going is people stop going because of just their habits and their rhythms. It's just life. So the top reason why somebody de-churched was they moved. The number two reason was attending church was inconvenient, and number three was some kind of family change. So think marriage, divorce, remarriage, the birth of a child, those kinds of things. So in the middle of all the bad news, there's actually a lot of good news. Because if most of the people stopped going to church for what we would call casual reasons, well, most of them are willing to return. Yeah. And the reasons why they stated of why they were willing to return, unlike the two older stories, were actually things that are well within our control. So, you know, the main, if we just boiled this thing down to just the absolute brass tacks, you know, what de-churched people are looking for is really two things. One, they're looking for healthy relationships with other people, just good friends and good community, and they're looking for a healthy local church. Well, that's great news.
Yeah.
Because right. These are things that
want those things.
These are things that are well within our control.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, we can learn how to relate to people in ways that are more persuasive and understanding and empathetic and curious, and we can build healthier local churches. You know, this is not rocket science. Mm-hmm. And so in the middle of all the bad news, there's actually a lot of good news. And, you know, and hopefully, you know, probably the number one thing, if you're listening to this, that what Jim and I would like to inspire people to, you know, again, after you read the book and, you know, educate yourself more on the different profiles and those different kinds of things.
So the number one thing you want is go buy the book. That's, no, I'm kidding. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, you can say that. I can't. Or you just read many of the things that we put on the internet. You don't need to buy the book or whatever. Anyways. But we want to inspire people to take educated relational risks. The internet's like this funhouse mirror, you know, that certain things, you know, so you go to like the county fair and, mm-hmm. you know, you got the undulating mirror that's not flat and it's like certain things make, or, you know, are wider than what they appear and other right. things, you know, some things are bigger than what they are and other things are smaller. It's like, well, the internet does that to you, you know, it's a funhouse mirror, but it's like the reality is there's a lot of people who are very persuadable. And there's a lot of people who are very open to things. So we have to fight against the temptation that, oh, if I have a spiritual conversation with somebody or if I'm inviting them to church, this is a potentially relationship-ending, like, avenue of conversation that I'm going down. For most people, it's not. It's not going to end your relationship. It may even be, you know, the next step in, you know, a greater, you know, intimacy mm-hmm. with another person. So, you know,
and it also, you know, the old stories can place blame and responsibility elsewhere, right?
Yes.
The majority story, the story that isn't told as much is one that sort of puts responsibility on us, right?
Yeah.
To take that relational risk, to engage with those who very likely would be open to being a part of our congregation if they can find healthy relationships yep. in a healthy context.
Yeah.
Wow. Man, we went deep and far and wide on a couple subjects there, and I appreciate you. You're here on campus today. You're doing chapel. You're going to do some stuff with our seminary. We just really appreciate you and the work done at TGC, the Keller Center. I've read the book. It's wonderful. Good reminder. Convicting and has a lot of fantastic data that backs up a simple solution that Jesus called us to in the first place. Yeah. So I appreciate all that good work. If people want to learn more about you, learn more about your work, what's the best ways to do that?
Yeah, probably the best thing to do, just go to thekellercenter.org, thekellercenter.org, and just sign up for the email newsletter. We only send out one email a month, and you can see all the stuff that we're doing on all these different things. Or you can go to thegospelcoalition.org. There's something for everybody there.
There is. Thank you for being on the podcast and for sharing the day with us here at Grace.
Thank you, Drew.
And thanks to all of you for listening to the Grace Story podcast. Thanks to Troy and Rick for their work producing it. We would love for you to like, comment, subscribe, share it with someone that you know would enjoy this. And if you have questions or comments you'd like to share, feel free to email us at podcast@grace.edu. Until next time, live your best Grace Story today.